From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue and in Franchise, Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where Nice Game Devs talk gaming and game development.
I'm Ellen Burns Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy, and I'm not going to edit any of that.
For this week's episode, our topics are power-ups and franchises. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start.
Did I mean, just at the right time?
Are you editing this episode?
I hope so.
You know what? If I'm editing it, I'm not going to do it either, because then I don't have to do any more work. So
it's true.
I will forget that I have to edit it.
Okay.
And then I'll want to rush through it, cool. So I won't do it.
See, we're not infallible. Sometimes we make mistakes too, listeners.
Often.
Yeah.
I almost tripped over and like... I tripped on, when I stood up from this chair and nearly tipped the whole table over.
Oh, my.
You guys didn't realize that.
Okay, yeah.
I missed that because I don't remember having a heart attack.
Yeah.
Yeah, these are... We all have our expensive laptops on this table.
And all the audio equipment and the mics.
Yeah, none of that's fun.
So I'll just sit here now.
Yeah. Speaking well, it's funny you say that. We've recorded in the new clubhouse for a couple of sessions now, three or four. Mm-hmm. I actually don't remember. At least three.
Yeah.
Are we used to the new space yet?
I think
so. Does it not feel new anymore? It's starting to feel a little bit like...
Switching seats.
Well,
that's true.
Part of the problem.
But each seat is the same chair.
Well, yes, but the position is different. And that affects the vibe.
So, Ellen, are you used to the space?
I think I'm just really tired today.
Yeah.
And we'll get to that. I mean, I think I've been saying that every single episode we've recorded for like the last month and a half. And it's still true every time. It's just been a really busy fall for lots of different reasons.
Part of adult life is being tired all the time.
You've been in this long period of moving.
Right.
Well, at first there was a long period of working really hard.
Yes.
And then when that started to wind down, then we sold our house and bought a new house and now we're moving. Mm. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And you didn't do it all in one weekend. It's like you stressed it out.
We're stretching it out, which is good because, I mean, it's good and bad, right? If you had just kind of crammed it into one weekend, then you just down a lot of caffeine and power through.
Yeah, an extremely stressful weekend.
Right? But I did that, and right. I still have a lot of work to do.
So. Oh,
right.
Yep. It's just a lot. It's just a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, moving's hard.
Yeah, moving's hard, and it's dark now. And there is one good thing in that. Well, there's a couple good things. One, it was just Halloween.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So from when we're recording, Halloween was yesterday.
Right. So what's the good thing?
All the candy.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. Candy's
Come
good.
On, Mark. I know you don't like Halloween, but like there is candy.
Yeah.
And like cool costumes that you sometimes see people wearing. Like Dale has a cool costume.
That's true.
Dale does have a very cool costume.
See if we can get a picture of that.
Yeah. Let's not say what it is. Yeah. Let's just put a picture in the show notes.
Yes.
Da-da-da. It's a very cool costume. And I think listeners will really like it.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. My favorite costume that I saw in the neighborhood trick-or-treaters yesterday was a tiny Batman.
I'm Batman.
He didn't say that. He just said, I really like your dog. And then he got to pet my dog. And
okay, that's cute.
He was like a 4-year-old Batman. Just adorable. My nephew's dressed up as a long-necked dinosaur.
Oh.
There was a specific scientific name attached to this long-necked dinosaur, but I honestly can't pronounce it. My 5-year-old nephew can. I can't. And then my other nephew, who's 6, he was a colossal squid.
Wow.
Yeah. And these are like inflatable costumes. So when he's running, like all the squid arms are like flailing around.
That's good.
Pretty great.
That's pretty good.
That's wonderful.
I'm seeing a lot of dogs on Twitter dressed up. And if you shoot a video of a dog in a certain way when they have these costumes on, they just look like tiny standing upright bears or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, I think people probably know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And they're very cute.
Did you ever see that? It was like a social media artist, right? It was a multimedia artist out of, I can't remember, some Scandinavian country. I can't remember. But he created like an amazing spider costume for his dog and then staged a bunch of like hilarious attacks from the spider. And it was actually, the spider costume was really scary.
Oh, wow.
My first thought after seeing that video, because it's really, really clever and funny, is that I really hope that person tracked down all the people he scared and gave them $50.
Yeah.
Like, because that's kind of a mean thing to do to somebody.
Well, and potentially dangerous for the dog. Because if I saw a spider the size of, you know, like, a dog coming at me and I knew it was a spider, I would be very freaked out.
Yeah, that'll get you.
Yeah, but I, from what I understand from just reading about this whole thing on the internet, and you know, it's the internet, so what do you know? They were paid actors.
Oh, okay.
And knowing that's the case, if that's the case, it still doesn't make it any less awesome. Really great.
I think the best part about that costume is that it's a little dog that moves like a little dog does.
Yeah.
You know, and when they have a collar, it's like the little jingle of their collar. Like mm-hmm. something about little dogs running is just very cute.
Yeah.
And it's exactly that motion that made the spider creepy.
Yes, exactly. It's totally true.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. what else is going on?
So much is going on. This is the fall season of new science fiction. Ooh. I'm really just pretty excited because there's a new Star Trek series that just started. Yeah. It's a kid's show, Star Trek Prodigy. And I had kind of low expectations for it because it's a kid's show. And I was like, it's not going to be targeted at me. It's going to be for kids and that's fine. Mm-hmm. And I'll just be happy it exists. But we watched the pilot last week and it was really good. I liked it.
Yay.
Like, it's still a kid's show. And in that vein, it has a couple of the tropes from like of animation targeted at those things. But I think it was It's a neat little expansion of the Star Trek universe, and I've been really excited about all these Star Trek shows lately. So
I'm more looking forward to the second episode because the first episode kind of just introduces the characters.
Mm-hmm. It was lots of setup. Yep. Yeah. Now the premise is going to get going.
Yeah.
I don't actually know what the series is like. Like, is it going to be really serialized? Because that first episode was all set up, so we don't know what the status quo is.
Yep.
You know,
you're on a cliffhanger almost.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I've had mixed experiences with series that were, you know, targeted towards kids.
Yeah.
And like for Star Wars, I loved Rebels and the Clone Wars. I loved the Clone Wars. And I tried to pick up Resistance, and Resistance was targeted towards a younger age demographic, and I just totally couldn't do it. Sure. But I'm excited if there's a Star Trek.
Yeah.
I'm like, Star Trek's good.
I think the thing that really makes it a kid's show, and this is the worst I could say about it, is that the humor is like not great. it's very simple. It's like it's a little bit too broad and it's not very sophisticated, but it's very much by design that way. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing bad or like broken about it. It's just like you're not really gonna it's a funny, like all kids shows have humor in them.
Yeah.
But it's not very funny.
Yeah.
But it is what it wants to be. Mm-hmm. And I like, you know, as a total Star Trek nerd, like every little Easter egg I get excited about. So like that will keep me engaged, I guess. Mm-hmm. I do hope that kids like it.
Yeah.
You know. But then Star Trek Discovery is coming back for its fourth season pretty soon. There's going to be another new Star Trek series early next year. Star Trek Picard is coming back for its second season.
Oh, man.
It's like this is like the time to be into Star Trek. There's never been more new Star Trek since like 1999.
So if you aren't into Star Trek and all the previous mentions about Star Trek on this show didn't
what are you
get
waiting
into Star
for?
Trek, now's the time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's going to be a new Ghostbusters movie, which has been, it should have come out like last year. It got delayed and delayed and delayed.
Oh.
But the it's going to come out when, I think the same day that Star Trek Discovery season 4 premieres, and on that same day, Star Trek Prodigy will also have a new episode.
So you have to take that day off.
I kind of do.
Yeah.
But I tweeted about this. Like, if you had told me 10 years ago or 20 years ago that there would be a day where two new Star Treks and a new Ghostbusters would come out in the same weekend, I just would not have believed you.
Mm.
Like, yeah. It's kind of, you know.
Yeah.
It's, I think when you get old enough, all the nostalgia is targeted at you, I think.
Yes, because you've got the money now.
It's going to happen to all of us, I guess. Like, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. But it's fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like all the new fun stuff, like I'm paying a lot more attention to like media that's coming out now because I'm not going to be outside as much. It's getting cold.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Like what's going to, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, it's still pandemic season. Like I haven't gone to restaurants indoors other than a brief 2-week period in May when we thought things were going to get better.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have started to do that. And that's the judgment they've made because of the risk assessment. And, you know, we'll see where we are in a couple of months. But I'm like, well, I guess I'm just going to go back and be a hermit this winter again. And I wasn't really prepared for that.
Well, are you going to be a hermit with your friends?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's true. I mean, we're here in person together, and that my bubble has gotten bigger, so that's definitely a thing. And we're here at the office, and you know, it's gonna be better.
Yes.
But I was expecting to go to museums or something,
sure.
You know, like to do other things.
Yeah, to do some things indoors, not in your.
Yeah,
place. I get that.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, on other news, I beat Deathloop.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you weren't that happy about it.
No, I was not.
You're not going to spoil it on the air, but you did tell me a little bit about what disappointed you.
Yeah. I think a previous episode I was talking about how much fun I was having playing Deathloop, but after a while I like fell off of it.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I think it was just, I don't know, I stopped playing games as much. But like I felt obligated to beat it, and also, you know, eventually I need to get to this new Metroid. So I was like, I gotta beat this game. I'm gonna beat this game. So I went ahead and I beat the game. But the ending was disappointing for me. And I've heard for some people too. For a bunch of reasons that I will not disclose.
Yeah. Well, I posited a theory that you dismissed, which is that this happens in a lot of games where the endings feel rushed and incomplete, partly because that's crunch time.
Yeah.
And that seems a little bit simplistic, but it actually is often true that the end of the game is the last thing that gets worked on,
yes.
or at least part of the last period. And then a lot of times it gets pared down and pared down because they have to fix parts in the beginning of the game and they have to spend more of time near the end, except for doing more than what they were planning. And so that does happen a lot with games.
Yeah, but it felt intentional.
Yeah, you didn't see the signs of that here.
No, I did not, no.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I don't know.
Yeah. Ooh, that would be a good topic we should do someday.
Yeah?
The signs of crunch.
Oh,
that's interesting. That's fascinating. There was a really good article about Mass Effect 3. No, it's a YouTube video of interviews with a lot of the developers of Mass Effect 3 talking about the crunch period at the end of that game's development and then the public reaction to the ending, which was very sour, and then the immediate, maybe 4 weeks later, commitment to make an extended version of the ending and then back to crunch to do that, which only came out, you know, maybe 2 months after that.
Yeah.
And just a lot of people reflecting on whether it was a good idea. And they're split. Some of the developers at the time are like, yep, I'm glad we went back and did that. Other people are like, you know what? It was done. We shouldn't have given in to this fan demand. Other people are mixed, like, oh, this set a standard which we don't like, but I'm glad we did it.
Yeah.
Like, it's really interesting to hear firsthand from some of these people. I'll find that link and we'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. That'll be good.
Yeah. Because, I mean, we've all done it. We've all worked too hard, and you sort of don't regret it all the time. You know? Like, you know intellectually that was a bad choice, but sometimes you kind of see the silver linings.
Yeah. Whenever I've done crunch, like I've done a game jam, which is like a day of crunch, which isn't that extreme. But like when I do it, then it's fine. But if I ever do it for any of the projects I'm working, like I'm actively working on it for a long period of time, I almost always regret it.
Yeah,
it's just me.
No, I mean you do always regret it, but like, but
then you forget about it and you do it again.
Yeah, or you think like, well, what else would I was gonna do? You know, like it wouldn't have gotten done, and it got done, and I'm happy with, you know what I mean.
Right.
Yeah. So that's part of the reason why it's hard to change this culturally.
Yeah.
You know.
Yep.
You can have mixed emotions about something.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's allowed.
Absolutely.
True.
Speaking of mixed emotions, we all saw Dune.
Wow.
I saw this on the bullet point. Although it got a good transition for it.
We were listing a bunch of stuff that we wanted to talk about meta, because it's kind of been a while since we checked in with each other.
Yeah.
And one of the things we completely forgot to put down here was the fact that we all went and saw Dune together.
Yeah. And that was your husband rented a theater.
Yeah.
And so it's the first time I've been to a theater probably longer than 18 months, because I wasn't seeing a lot of movies at the beginning of 2020.
Right.
And so it was a very weird experience.
Yeah, it was. So it never occurred to me ever to do this, but, you know, my husband just was like, I want to see Dune, but I don't want to go to the theater. What if it's just people I know? And then he researched it and he's like, oh no, you could just rent out a theater.
Yeah, it's pretty common now, actually.
Yeah, it's a common thing right now. And so he just rented the theater, and then we just let everybody know, hey, we rented this theater. Please come so that we don't have to spend hundreds of dollars just to sit in there with the two of us.
Yeah.
Although that would have been cool too. But yeah, we filled up like, I don't know, half of the seats or more. And I got to meet Stephen's parents.
Oh yeah, my parents were there.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
My parents are cool.
Yes.
As of what other people say. Obviously, I don't think my parents
Everyone was
are
happy
cool.
to see or meet your parents, and they were happy to see all of us. And you were just like, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
It's fine. Yeah, I mean, you invited them. I don't know what you were expecting.
I regressed back to like high school.
So did you like Dune?
I feel like I can't be honest.
This is Nice Games Club.
If I say that I like it, then I feel like you're going to laugh at me.
No, if you liked it, it's cool.
I liked it. I thought it was entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was it's been a really long time since I read the book, and I haven't read all of the books.
Yeah.
And after we saw the movie, I did get on fandom.com and read summaries of all the books that come in after that. Whoo, boy.
Yeah. It gets weird.
It gets wild. It's so weird. It just like everything. I'm not into Warhammer 40K, but I have friends who are very into Warhammer 40K. And when I have friends who are into a thing, I also go to fandom.com and learn as much as I can about the thing.
Yeah.
Because then I can get excited about the thing that they're excited about.
Oh, sure.
And there are some things that like conceptually are like, well, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Kind of like the Battle Nuns. They're cool. Okay. In like a Warhammer 40K sense. Anyway,
sure. Yeah.
There's a ton of stuff like in the lore of Dune that really reminded me of Warhammer. And that was really interesting. So there's more I wanted to get into about that. Like there might be some idea like genealogy.
Future topic, Dune.
I'm not qualified to talk on either one of these at length.
Scratching out the top.
No, but I can find people who are.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, you know, it was like a really good world building movie, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was pretty cool. And what was nice is like with science fiction, the world building stage of a science fiction story is always fun. Always fun.
Yeah.
And then when the story has to get personal, some stories make that pivot work and other stories don't. And I don't know if Dune ever actually needs to make that pivot in the first book. So, it was a beautiful movie.
Yeah.
And the worms were cool and the music was awesome. And
yes. Oh gosh. The music is my favorite part of that whole, whole experience.
It didn't hit me that hard. I didn't have a lot of opinion on it.
Oh, okay.
It was okay. I didn't.
I don't know. I think it was just, it felt very alien.
Yeah.
But still like.
I mean, maybe it did its job. It was very suitable. Like it really fit the movie.
That's the thing is I went back and listened to the soundtrack afterwards. I was like, this isn't as good as I remember it being. And I think it's just because like
half the picture.
Yeah. Whereas other soundtracks, movie soundtracks I've listened to, like I still like them as much.
Mm-hmm.
This one did not evoke that. And I think part of the reason why it didn't evoke as much feeling when I listened to it back is because like I thought that Dune was okay. It was fun. Mm-hmm. Like I enjoyed watching it for the most part. It was kind of slow I have never seen any other Dune media, so I don't know much about the whole lore and stuff.
Yeah, it's a pretty faithful adaptation, I would say.
I mean
Cards on the Table, I hate that book. I really like David Lynch, and I thought David Lynch did as good a job as he could have adapting it into a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought Denis Villeneuve did the same, as good as he could have done with that book. I don't know if I've talked about it on the show before, but I love Arrival. It's one of my very favorite movies.
So good.
And he brought a lot of that sensibility to Dune, that idea of like, you don't have to linger on something for too long. You can have a lot of evocative imagery without explaining all of it. Mm-hmm. And the problem with Dune is the opposite of that.
Yeah.
Dune is the, here's a proper noun and here's 15 pages of what it's all about. And a lot of the script of this movie did fall prey to that. Like, here's this weird compass, let me tell you about it. Like, here are the still suits, let me explain it to you.
Yeah.
And that's the structure of that story, is like, here's a new idea, here's some exposition, then we do something with that thing, and then we introduce a new thing and some exposition, and it seems very, I don't know, I don't like that about the story. And I think that being so faithful in an adaptation, I think hurt it a little bit.
Mm.
Whereas that director's sensibility is really appropriate for this story.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he was too faithful, but that's just because I don't like the book. I think it needs some changes, but if you wanted to do that story, it's the best adaptation you could have hoped for if you're a fan of the book. So
yeah.
I didn't really love it, but I also feel like, what else could it have been?
Sure. You know? Yeah.
Big worms are cool.
Yeah.
Big worms are cool.
That is true. I mean, the design is really, really good.
Yeah, visuals
like,
were good.
Yeah.
Agree with that.
Do you think it'll be true 10,000 years in the future that if you live on a desert planet, you have to be in drapey linens?
Yep, that's mandatory.
Yeah.
I feel like every space opera or science fiction show that has a desert planet, you're in drapey linens.
Well, ultimately, they're all like based off of Earth.
Yeah.
So that's just.
Well, it's a
drapey space linen.
I mean,
okay.
I'm in a voyage outside of your bit right now, because I think there's a reason for that kind of imagery, which is this notion of like, this sort of medievalist kind of idea. Yeah. Like this, it's evoking other familiar tropes, but in a different setting. And so you see that a lot. You'll see, I mean, in Dune, there were like this sort of the Catholic spacesuits or whatever at the very beginning, right?
Yeah.
There's lots of stuff like that. And I think that's Would it really look like that? Well, certainly not. But those markers are meant for us to contextualize the out of contextness of it.
Yep.
And I think that's good design, but it's not proper speculative fiction. But it wasn't designed for that purpose,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, it makes sense.
I did like the bagpipes. I will say that. That's my last closing thought about.
And then it comes out of nowhere is the best part. I don't know if it's in the book or not, but like I was very surprised.
I don't think it was. I don't think that it was. Mm-hmm. But
the best part about that shot is you hear the bagpipes for like 5 seconds before you see the person playing the bagpipes, and you see them enter the frame, and there's somebody in the foreground with their shoulder blocking. So you see the bagpipes, the person playing the bagpipes, you see their head, mm-hmm. you see the bagpipes, and you're like, is he wearing a kilt? Is he wearing a kilt? Is he wearing a kilt? And nope, he's wearing pants. So if you watch Dune again for that shot,
I will.
Just worth it. That four seconds of like, is there a kilt? Is there a kilt? It was the most thrilling that movie got.
Savage.
Yeah. They're a good burn, though.
Yeah.
Dune was the only fun I've had. Dune and podcast recording is the only fun I've had for like 3 weeks.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Oof. When does this period end for you?
I feel like I keep saying next week. but probably next week.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, we moved a whole bunch of stuff over the weekend. And maybe someday I'll be able to play a video game again.
Hey. Yeah. I'm still the only one who's played Metroid.
Apparently, you've almost beaten it.
I'll buy it when I get home.
You don't even have it sitting in your home screen to tempt you?
No.
That's Steven's version of maybe next week.
No, I've been doing that thing I do with AAA games where I marathon it in like 4 or 5 sessions.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the way I can fit it into my life and also makes me stay up too late. One of the many reasons. But no, I got to the point where it's like, okay, time to do the final boss now. Like you get the clues, like it's you take the elevator and then it's pointed over turn or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right, I'm gonna go look around for a bunch of stuff. I'm gonna collect a lot of things as much as until I get bored, then I will go face the final boss. And I'm like, I got all the toys. I think I have all of Samus's gear. But there's a bunch of places I definitely can't reach, and they all have a very similar quality to them. So I must be missing, and it's the only type of thing I can't access. I have one thing in common, how it's placed. And so I know I'm missing one thing.
Yeah.
And so I scoured the entire map looking for rooms that I hadn't seen before.
Yeah.
And anytime I found something I hadn't seen before, it just led me to another one of these things that I couldn't reach because I didn't have the thing I needed.
Right.
And so I was convinced I was just missing one thing. And so I looked all over it and I finally, you know what? I haven't done it yet for this game, but I'm going to look up where this final thing is. I've searched the whole map. I've done my due diligence. I'm just going to find out where it is. Mm. I look it up and I know I had all the things. Oh. I was just wandering the map for no reason.
Yep.
It's just that there's a power-up that gives you 2 power-ups when you get it, but only explains how to use one of them.
Oh.
People who played Metroid probably know what I'm talking about.
Yep.
I just didn't know I could do this. I think it probably did explain it to me, and I probably just didn't internalize it. But I spent all this time. Turns out I had it within me the whole time to do these things.
The power was within you.
Yeah, so I think I'm just going to go... When I get home, I'm just going to go get the final boss.
Yeah, nice. Nice.
And that's our topic. Power-ups.
Yes, that whole preamble, this whole 20-minute opening of the show,
yep.
I don't know if it's a record, but it's close, is to get into my topic for today, which is power-ups. Mm-hmm. I just want to talk about, they feel kind of like, oh, I know what a power-up is, but they have really different ways of interacting. Mm-hmm. And they sometimes, they're very frequently mutually exclusive. Mm. And I kind of want to get into that, whether that's... If maybe I'm making a big deal out of that, but like, is that something that is required, or is that something just naturally we just develop games that way?
Oh, so, I can talk about that when we get to it. Yeah.
Okay. So the first thing is power-ups as upgrades. So this is the Metroidvania thing. So this is you get more powerful. Not always a Metroidvania exclusive kind of thing. It's very frequently just levels get harder, and you get the power-ups you need as you go. Mm-hmm. But that's pretty common. They're permanent upgrades, or they're new weapons. I really like the way that Metroid Dread does it, because one of the things that's kept me from finishing any other Metroid is I keep hearing about the 30 upgrades, and I'm like, there's only 2 buttons on an NES controller. How are there so many upgrades?
Yeah.
And it's because it just changes the way you play. Mm-hmm. You upgrade the missile 4 or 5 times, but you never change how you shoot a missile.
Right.
And it doesn't take away, like, there's maybe one example in Metroid Dread, but like, it adds things. Occasionally, we'll add new button combinations, and there is a lot in Metroid Dread. It uses all the buttons.
I believe it.
But once it starts adding things, upgrades to things you already have, it doesn't change how you use it. Just change what it does, mm-hmm. without removing the way for you to use it in the way you were previously using it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. So it doesn't change it in a way that breaks or prevents you from doing things the way you previously had tried.
Right.
Yeah.
And that is really, really good design. Mm-hmm. And I didn't give mm-hmm. Metroid enough credit because I never got far enough into a Metroid to know that's how that works.
Yeah. Or,
you know? But I mean, Ellen, you have the most Metroid experience here at the table.
Mm. Yeah, I guess. Well, maybe. Maybe before you play Dread all the way to almost the end. Specifically to spite me, is that say.
I mean, there were other reasons.
No, it is. Like, yeah, with, you know, when you were talking about how you were struggling, you know, to figure out what these extra rooms were about, and it turned out it was just a way that you could use one of your existing abilities in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
I thought of two things. One, the fact whenever I get stuck, I just bomb everything. I just go turn into a morph ball and I bomb everything. And sometimes that works and usually it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is, like, I just clearly saw in my mind the Super Metroid menu where you can go in and you can toggle certain power-ups on and off. And that was one of the fun things.
Oh, okay.
Super Metroid was my first introduction to the franchise. And when I realized you could do that, I'm like, oh, this is really cool. Let's see all the different beams I can do.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I would just, like, turn off the ice beam and go with go with the wave beam and just see what would happen with that and what it would actually do. And I did a lot of experimentation, just switching things on and off on certain settings and figuring out what, you know, how I could use different beams in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, if it doesn't always tell you all the things you can do. Except for when like there is a new upgrade and it's a key upgrade and there's like a puzzle you have to solve with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I will say, one of the things I liked about Metroid Dread, and this might be something that, it's something about Metroidvanias that I don't like, is that Metroidvanias tell you they're nonlinear, but they're just super linear.
Yeah.
They just don't, it's just behind the smoke and mirrors. Yeah. And Metroid Dread is not afraid to just lead you by the nose a little bit. And I like that quite a lot.
Okay. We'll see when I play it if I like it.
Here's the thing. you have to pay attention to see those signs.
Okay.
But basically, it's very difficult to get lost or to not know where to go next or to not have your context.
That's true. That's
you mm-hmm. need to be engaged to do it. It's not patronizing,
mm-hmm.
but it's not inscrutable for its own sake,
okay.
which I think is like, that's not what challenge is. That's not an effective puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
That's just, you know, that's just tedium for no reason. Mm-hmm. And that's generally my complaint about Metroidvanias as a genre. And so I bounced off of Ori for that reason. It was just, it flummoxed me in ways that were just not in its own interest, you know, very frequently. But I think this might be a minority opinion. I'm not sure. But Metroid Dread is just not afraid to be like, you got the new power up. Here's to get out of the room we just gave it to you. Here's the obvious way to do it.
Yeah.
And the next place you need to use it, you probably remember seeing it on your way here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's not a lot of, I have to scour the map for what this opens up for me now.
Okay.
But the more you do remember your path and the map, the more you can stumble upon those things as you keep going.
Mm-hmm.
But the critical path is always, they do a really good job of making you not have to remember that far back.
Okay.
So if you are paying a little bit of attention, you're always going to be fine.
Okay.
And I think that's really good, good. Yeah. About the game.
That sounds like
And a lot of that is just that the sequence of power-ups as those upgrades. So that's the you know, getting back on topic.
Right.
We did this for Widget Satchel, but we did it in a way that was very nonlinear in the fact that it was multipath, right? You could pick which power-up you got.
Yes.
And I'm not sure that we were 100% successful in finding really... there were like the good ways to do it and like clumsy ways to do it. We wanted to punish players who got a lot of widgets early on and bought the most expensive thing.
Yeah.
Like we wanted to make that like, we wanted to teach them not to go for that base instinct, I guess. But otherwise we had kind of like two or three good orders to do it mm-hmm. that were mostly intuitive.
Yeah.
But I don't know if did a lot of thinking about that, other than just the immediate needs that the game had. Like, I don't know. What is your memory of that?
Because
it was part of the core of the game originally.
Yeah.
And so it was a thing we didn't want to change.
Yeah.
But we didn't interrogate it that much, I don't think.
Yeah. I think a lot of my focus on the game was focused on the what did we always call it? The path that gives you all the
optimal
things.
Path.
Optimal path.
Yeah.
So I feel like a lot of my thinking was around that and not so much about, people can just choose whatever, because I assume people would just be able to choose whatever.
Yeah.
And ultimately,
right, we focused on not blocking someone's ability. There's no, there's no wrong choices.
Yes.
But we didn't always, we thought about a couple of obvious choices that would feel good. And then we had the optimal path, which required, it really, you'd never get it on your first try. Yeah. And that was not our intent. So I think that worked out fine. Mm-hmm. But we didn't fill in the rest of those blanks, I don't think.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we could have done a better job about it. And I think part of it is just like the opportunity to backtrack that's in Metroidvanias and stuff isn't really in this, in Widget Satchel as much.
It's very limited, but it's part of that optimal path. So very frequently players will never see it.
So yeah. So I think that if we had more opportunities for people to backtrack, it would come across a little bit better.
Yeah.
In that way. But that's fine. That's what Super Widget Satchel's for, I guess.
Yeah, but one of the things we did do is in level 5, the final level of the game, it does reward you for having collected them all up to that point.
Yes.
So there's that notion of the power up, and in the very final sequence of the last level, it gives you the opportunity to afford the most expensive shuttle at the end of the game, but only really if you have all of the upgrades.
Yeah.
And that was sort of very much by design to reward players. But I think we also, we were very concerned about like players who didn't do as well and wanted to make sure they did fine. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that we spent enough time rewarding players outside the optimal path.
Yeah.
In that way.
I would agree with that.
But that's sort of a different approach to what other games use power-ups for. Mm-hmm. So like the next one on my list here is consumables.
Sure.
So shoot 'em ups have this pretty frequently.
Yes.
And the one example I had, I don't know, this is probably not the best one, is like Arkanoid. Like Breakout?
Yeah, it totally does.
That's the one I think about.
The best Breakout games are the ones with fancy fun power-ups.
Yeah.
I agree with that. Mm-hmm. I agree with that perspective.
Yeah, and it's very, very different from any other kind of upgrade scheme, even like in Mario when you get and lose Firefly or whatever.
Yeah.
A lot of times the upgrades are timed or they're just for the rest of this life.
Yep.
Instead of, you can't really get it and lose it. And they're very specifically tailored to be temporary.
Pinball does this too.
That's true. That's a good, this, I didn't think about that. Yeah.
Time, yeah, there's opportunities for you to like get a second ball and you'll have to balance both of the balls and they'll mm-hmm. both fall in the hole because I don't know, you're bad at pinball.
Right, that's power up as burden.
Yeah.
I really like that as a game design thing. Yeah. There should be more of that. Power at a cost.
I mean, Widget Satchel did a little, well, not exactly. But you like picked up, I guess that was collectibles as burden.
Right, that's a different mechanic, but served the same function. That's a good connection.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I like these kinds of power ups because like you just feel, you know, you feel powerful for a period of time. You want to use it as best as you can so you can get the most points or whatever it is you're going for.
I think maybe the examples we're thinking of are arcades examples, probably because this is the most, I would say, simplest way to do power-ups.
Sure.
Is just to change things for a bit and then go back to normal.
Yeah.
It's very hard to break your game.
Oh, Pac-Man. Sorry. Pac-Man is an example of this. It's literally a consumable.
No. I mean, it is literally consumable, but actually that's an example of the next one, which I'll move right to, is power-ups to change the mechanics of play. Mm. So Mario is very much this, right?
Yeah.
Is you move differently when you have the extra abilities, right? It doesn't change what your thing does, like in Breakout or something like that. But Pac-Man's a good example of that. You get the power-up, and then now you're playing a different game.
Got it. Okay.
Right?
That's fair.
And it is temporary, but that's sort of outside the definition. I think more importantly, it changes the mechanic.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's part of a collection of mechanics, mm-hmm. right? So Pac-Man has only, just the two modes. But in Mario, you have the various power-ups that sort of form the complete Mario set.
Yeah.
And they're not permanent upgrades. They're, they're temporary in the sense that you can lose them. But they're not really, they're really more designed to just sort of mix and match the mechanics to complete the entire experience.
Sure.
And so they feel like they are power-ups, but I think when I get a fire flower, I don't feel powered up. I feel like, oh, I have the fire flower now.
Yeah.
Because it feels like part of the normal routine of playing a game.
Sure.
Whereas if I get like the spread fire 10 at a time thing in Arkanoid, I feel powered.
Yeah, okay.
Right?
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. I get that.
Yeah, and I think that's probably, I don't know, maybe that's probably the most common, type of power up in a more modern game.
In a platformer.
Yeah,
that's
true.
Not a Metroidvania, I think that's the case. Mm. I think that,
well, like weapons in Doom or Quake or any other, I went that far back, but in weapons are this, mm-hmm. right? Where you have the rocket launcher.
That's true.
For a while, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yep.
Right, and those put together, they all have to be balanced mm-hmm. in a way that like power ups in an arcade game don't have to be as balanced.
Yeah.
Or though those power-ups are maybe self-balancing because they're about about scores, and they're delivered at a certain pace, so it's equal between players.
Right.
But in this type of power up, it's much more about a set of mechanics that complete the whole experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a balanced challenge that I don't think designers think about often enough. Like, oh, we introduced this new idea in this level, and if it's only in this level, it's not going to feel balanced. Like, it's still going to play fine,
mm-hmm. yeah.
But it's going to feel like by the time I get to the end of the game, I'm like, what was that? I was really hoping I'd see that thing again. Or like, you introduce a power up early on and then lean on it really heavily for the rest of the game. Like, why isn't it just part of the default moveset then?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a harder balance challenge, and people don't consider it as a balance challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And it's a variety challenge, I suppose, mm-hmm. which is important.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to give players the sort of the, like, give them a rich experience, give them novelty, have what they do change over time.
Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, it makes you feel more powerful when you have a wider variety of essentially skills to bring to bear on problems that you're trying to solve.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, and it's not just power-ups for your player. It's also, I mean, for your character, it's also power-ups for your player.
Yeah. Oh, that's a really good way to put it. Yeah. My last category here, which is power-ups as level design.
Yeah.
And this is something I don't think people think about often enough, which is we try to do this in Widget Satchel, whereas the power-ups you get are only viable in the context of how the level is designed.
Mm. Yeah.
So, like, when you have the star power-up in Mario, that comes at a point where you need it because there are a bunch of enemies that are hard to get through, mm-hmm. or there's a certain a platform that you need to reach, and so you need a different jump ability or something. And so I think that is a pretty important concept there that I think is Metroidvanias do this really well, mm-hmm. but as you upgrade permanently, it sort of, like, at the end of when I got the screw attack, it's like enemies don't matter anymore.
Right, yeah.
And that is fun,
yeah.
But it's not quite the same as this, where sure. I feel like this is more, I mean, this is not like absolute, but an example of this would be more something where every time you go through that level, like as Mario, you pick up the same power at the same spot, and mm-hmm. you know, it's a singular mm-hmm. experience. It doesn't change the second time you go through it,
yeah.
but it changes from what you played just before that.
Sure.
You
know? Mm-hmm. Oh, it changes your experience because, like, you picked up power ups at different rates or different locations.
Yeah, it's a lot about the pacing, right?
Yeah,
so
okay.
so
okay.
Like Ellen was talking, like, sort of the distribution of power ups through a game.
Right.
That is only really meaningful if it interacts with how the levels are built.
Gotcha.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Like, yes. It's cool to get the, you know, like, if you're playing I don't have a lot of experience playing Contra, but I think about that as another game with, like, consumable.
Yeah.
Because it has kind of a shoot 'em up kind of quality to mm-hmm. it. I remember in that game, it didn't matter that much what part of the level I got the power up in. I just wanted a power up.
Yeah.
And I'll take any of them at any time.
Yeah. Well, I think, I don't remember if Contra did it specifically, but other games sometimes would just give you a random power up. I know that, like, Castlevania games will do that. At least the first one, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You get a random power up. And, like, I know that speedrunners try to manipulate RNG or whatever so they get the right power up that they want. But sometimes it's just not the case or whatever.
Yeah, I guess I didn't really think about that, is power-ups as chaos. Like, Mario Kart is that.
Oh, yeah, that's
right?
True.
And that's chaos. In competitive games, that's by design.
Yeah.
But I would say in a single-player game, that feels like randomness standing in for novelty or design.
I'm not arguing that this is a level design thing. I think it's
no,
more
no. Like, I'm just sort of I'm poo pooing the idea that, like, I feel like that you could have worked a little harder on that sort of thing. Like,
well,
if that's how your game is built,
I think it depends on the game. I'd say that it's more of an adaption sort of test.
Hmm. Well, and that's what can be fun about it is as chaos.
Yes.
Right.
Oh, yeah,
that can be fun.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that was the intent in Castlevania
or in
other games that do this, mm-hmm. but like but even in Mario, there's a couple of random power up blocks.
Yep.
But usually those. Almost always, those power, whatever you get, is irrelevant.
Yeah.
And that's partly because Mario games are so level design focused and where the power placement is so important that when it gives you a random one, it doesn't matter what you get because it never matters.
Because it wasn't. That's not the point of it at that point.
Yeah, you almost never feel like, oh, I got the good one. It's like, oh, I guess I got the one I would have wanted, but who cares? Because this level's not designed for me to need any of these.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
Okay, I have a question.
Yes.
How do roguelikes and roguelites fit into this?
It's a good question, and I don't have any answers for you on that because I don't have any experience with those genres.
Right.
Well,
Steven.
I can try to answer. I don't play a ton
just
of roguelikes.
Just your best shot.
So, I mean, well, actually, that's a good... Oh, okay. So, I'm thinking of Risk of Rain and its sequel, Risk of Rain 2.
Mm-hmm.
All of the items you get, you know, as you defeat things and open up chests and whatever else, you pick up random items, power-ups, and they affect your character's build,
yeah,
effectively. Like, they affect their stats, and that affects how you play the game. So arguably, this is a form of, it's not a form of changing mechanics, because you basically do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. It's progression. It's upgrades.
It's upgrades, exactly. And so...
But the path is unpredictable.
Yes, the path is unpredictable.
And that's what's interesting about it.
That's what makes it interesting as a roguelike, is that as you pick up these upgrades, and you get a lot of upgrades.
And the cool things that Hades yells at you between runs.
That's a good point. Hades is a good example, too.
That might be why I don't like the genre very much, is because, like, when I was playing Hades, one of the, you know, before I totally bounced off of it for other reasons, the thing that frustrated me most was, like, it gave me random power-ups. And I was like, I don't care. Like, just, like, I mastered this thing, this choice, and then the next time I play through, I have to do something totally different.
Sure.
Like, it's, then I'm spending all of my time learning and none of my time playing.
Yeah. Because what you're trying to do over the long haul is manipulate the state of the game so that certain power-ups are more frequent.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. To optimize your own play style.
Right.
Which I haven't gotten far enough into the game to get the fruits of that yet, but
yeah. And that would be very satisfying if, you know, but there has to be at least some interest in the task for the reward to feel worth it.
Right.
Yeah.
You know,
that's true. But yeah, I guess ultimately, there are power-ups as upgrades in that, you know, your character gets better over time with these different power-ups.
Right.
But they affect how you play in a way that is not the same as, like, a Metroidvania.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, you know, you get random ones.
Right. And that's a roguelite thing, right? In proper roguelikes, you always start with nothing. Mm-hmm. Right?
Well, yeah. Roguelikes and rogue... I guess... No. I guess it depends. Because some roguelites... roguelites. Like, when you come back to a new loop or whatever, you keep some of the abilities or some of the benefits that you picked up from previous.
There's not a hard and fast rule about these things.
Yes.
Okay. But it does change the way you play, and so the randomization gives you a wide variety of experiences, which is meant to help you. So there's, like, a lot of purpose to it,
right?
In a way that, like, you know. So I don't mean to disparage it. I think it's a matter of taste at that point. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, I guess that's the whole glossary. Like, it's there's.
So I wanted to talk. So to bring back to the question you proposed in the beginning.
Yeah.
Why, like, people kind of, or games tend to just have one type of power up?
Oh yeah.
I think the reason for that is because it complicates the game to a point that makes it difficult for a player to parse in the moment. Because I think we experimented with that a little bit in Fingence. Like, we had, you know, Fingence has regular upgrades that you get in between levels, but it also has, or we also attempted to, like, add in power-ups and things during the gameplay that you can pick up. And it just, like, muddied the effect of, like, the builds that you were working on in the initially. And it made it difficult to, like, understand what was happening in the moment.
Oh, it's interesting.
That
makes a lot of sense, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because when you're getting a power up, whether it's, like, at the end of a level or something, it's this momentary pause in the gameplay, but you do want to get right back at it, right?
Yeah.
Like, but yeah, I could see how mixing in additional power ups would be something that would, like, kind of interrupt your flow.
And it is difficult to learn as you're doing it too, because, like, what I experienced in Fingence is that people would, you know, they get a new augment and then they go to the next level and they try to understand what that augment does.
Yeah.
And so they're learning what that augment does over the course of that level.
Yeah.
And then they go to the next one and get a new augment. But, like, if you're learning what that augment does is, and, you know, during the course of that level, you get a new power up and you're trying to figure out how this augment works and you get this new power up that changes how your game works, or your gameplay works, it makes it difficult to learn what either thing does.
It's funny. This goes back to a thing that Ellen, you identified in a couple episodes ago, just expectations.
Yeah.
It's like, all of this comes down to that, the language of what you expect and what the game develops you to expect. Like, what's it telling you?
I said that?
Yeah.
That sounds kind of smart.
Well, I've been thinking ever since that episode. We were talking about something else, and then you framed it in that way. And then it's like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. And every topic since, I've thought framing it in that way is really helpful.
Yeah.
Think about, like, the two types of power-up systems. It's like, you know, one's Italian and one's Mandarin Chinese. And it's like, they're both fun to learn and use, but together it's not that helpful to learn one or the other if you have to learn them both at the same time and at random points or whatever.
Yeah.
It's a pretty strained metaphor, but I think that's
But it does make sense. It's difficult. It's hard to learn two languages at the same time.
Right.
You know, and actually, one of the things that does make it easier to learn two languages at the same time mm-hmm. is if it's very clear what you should expect from one context versus another, right? Oh, like, yeah. Okay, so the teacher's going to read me a book, and the first time I'm going to hear it, it's going to be in English, and the second time I hear it, it's going to be in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And when we're doing the Spanish read of the book, the whole read is in Spanish. When we're doing the English read of the book, the whole read is in English. And having, when you're first dealing with like people who are learning languages, I just learned this. I'm not a language learning expert, but I just learned this from other reasons. And like, that's an important thing that you want to do. You want to make it clear when you're introducing a word in one language or the other, because keeping that clarity of context is important to helping the person learning the language, whether they're a child or an adult, mm-hmm. build the right mental model of the language systems. And lo and behold, learning about games works the same way, apparently.
You know, the example I'm thinking of is like in Mario 3, there are like the gambling huts where where you spin the wheel. And Mario 2 has this also. Mm. And those are very different. And then you get like a random number of one-ups or something. Like you get, you're engaging a different kind of power-up mechanic, mm-hmm. but it's isolated and separate from the other type of play. Yes. And so it doesn't feel discordant in any way.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. And frankly, in Mario games, whenever you get a new power up, that level is almost always dedicated to that power up. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really give you, like, the new Super Mario Bros. Power ups give you a variety of different things. There's like a penguin suit and a propeller suit and a whole bunch of other junk. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes it's just segmented to like one part of a level or like that whole level.
Yeah.
So you can understand what that level is about.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It doesn't give you the penguin suit. I think I'm probably wrong. Somebody correct me. It doesn't give you the penguin suit and the propeller suit at the same time.
So it does do that sometimes, in that moment, then the player has a choice to make.
Right. Yeah.
And that's an interesting choice. If I'm going to choose this power up because it'll make this part of this next level easier, I'll take the propeller hat because there's a lot of pits and I want a second chance to get out of them. Mm-hmm. But I'll take the boomerang suit instead because there's also a lot of enemies and I'm not going to be able to navigate my jumps as well, but I'm pretty sure I can stay out of pits.
Yeah.
And so you can make that choice based on how that's really fun.
Right.
But also sometimes a power up will be there and you won't know why. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like figuring out like, because there's this alternate path to get one of those special coins. Yeah. And so it's not part of the normal playthrough. And when you get a power up in Mario that feels like it doesn't belong here, that kind of puts your mind into detective mode,
mm-hmm. yeah.
which is really fun. And because the game has taught you that everything is always there for a reason.
Yeah. And additionally, at the point where they're giving you those kinds of choices, you've experienced these power ups long enough to know what they do without you having to learn them on the fly.
Yep.
Yeah. So learning, it's fun.
You know, learning is fun, and my favorite power-up, I think, of all time, maybe this counts as a power-up. I think if a rocket launcher counts as a power-up, or this counts as a power-up, is in Super Mario Odyssey, one of the first islands you get to has a T-Rex, and you're just learning how to use the hat. And of course, you see a T-Rex, you're like, well, I wonder if I can control it with a hat. And you can.
Yeah.
And then you get to stomp around the island as a T-Rex for a while.
Yeah.
That was my favorite one.
Oh, and that's such a perfect example of a classic Mario teach you how to play moment. Mm-hmm. Whereas like you've used the hat a couple of times, but you kind of every enemy is enemy sized. Mm-hmm. And then you hit that and you're like, immediately your mind is, what else can this do?
Right.
Yeah.
And then you spend the rest of the game throwing your hat at everything.
At everything.
And you slowly learn the language of what is controllable.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you're not limited by like, how big this thing is. And eventually like you control a giant like a slab of meat in the middle of thing that you drop into a soup or something. Like there's just tons of things. And that's not as weird because you've been primed for that with that one surprise early on. And it's delightful.
Yeah,
it is. So I think that's something that we didn't really talk about, like it's sort of like how you put all your power-ups together, but like they all should be in communication with each other.
Yes.
Right. And that's, I think, important when you have like a really good idea for one. It's not a good idea unless it fits with all the other ideas. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the hardest thing to do when you develop something like this, because anytime you come with a new idea, you then have to, it's like when they introduce a new character into Smash, Kirby has to swallow them.
Yes.
So you have to do some work there too.
That's so funny because I'm in the Kirby Smash Discord, and whenever there's a new Smash.
The Kirby Smash Discord.
Look, okay.
Of course that exists.
Of course.
Why would I have ever thought that wasn't a thing and that you weren't part of it?
Exactly.
It's sounds like a great place.
It is a great place. That's where I get all my Discord furries. But what's interesting is, like, whenever there's a new Smash character announced, they don't announce it as a new Smash character. They're like, a new Kirby power has been unlocked. Oh, it's very fun.
Hey, folks, quick message. Follow us on Twitter, please.
There you go.
Message.
And send tweets.
That's it, yeah. Follow us on Twitter,
send a tweet. Send a tweet.
We prepared a couple of reasons why you might want to do this.
Right.
I don't know why I have to go through this. I'm obligated, but really, you should just follow us on Twitter.
People like lists.
First one, Dale, who runs our Twitter. Very, very cool.
Awesome. Yes.
So cool.
Dale retweets the best stuff in game dev, the coolest, funniest jokes, and also really, really good tutorial content that she comes across, and like lessons learned from developers, and some like she's a really good curator of game dev Twitter, and that happens on our Twitter, and you should follow it for that reason.
Yeah.
We have an example here, Steven,
should I read it?
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah.
I've been a graphics programmer on Darkest Dungeon 2 for a little over a year now, and I've seen some such twisted evil things, horrors which would drive ordinary mortals mad. But leaving Unity aside, the lores and stuff are pretty cool.
So funny.
Yeah.
So lots of really well put, relatable content that gets retweeted by our account. And you'll find you'll find stuff about the show.
Yes.
When we're doing special events, when we release new content on Patreon. Mm-hmm. Of course, new episode announcements come out on Twitter as well.
Right.
So if you don't want to, just follow us because of us, fine. I mean, that's fine.
Yeah.
But really, it's for the rest of the window into maybe the game dev Twitter that you aren't quite part of yet. And maybe you can find new people to follow and expand your curatorial reach on Twitter. I think that's a really good reason as well. So I think that covers it, right, Steven?
Yes.
I'll give a metaphor.
Okay.
All right. So if you have like trail mix, right?
Mm-hmm.
Proper trail mix.
Like where this is going.
Yeah. You know where it's going, right? Proper trail mix that has M&Ms in it.
I don't know where this is going. I just like where it's going.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. It's like Dale has picked out all the M&Ms for you already.
Oh.
Okay.
That's very good.
And also it's different than just giving you a bag of M&Ms, right? That's right. Different. I just want to make sure that's clear.
Right. Because it's forged by experience and had a little bit of salt on it.
Right. Exactly.
At Nice Games Club.
All right, Ellen, we're at 53 minutes, and I know you like to keep these shows around an hour.
I do.
Do you think you can truncate your topic? Would that suit your tired mind?
We'll see what we can do.
Okay.
The thing that's really interesting is, and I'm really glad that we paired these topics together because we talked a lot for the first one, which meant that I didn't have to do, I feel like I don't have to really drag a
production
lot of
secrets,
heavy
folks. This is how the sausage one is made.
Yeah.
Usually not, but today, yeah, for aforementioned reasons. But I want to talk about franchises because, well, I have some questions.
Uh-huh.
And I'm glad we talked about power-ups first because a lot of the games we mentioned in that segment are part of franchises,
yeah,
right? So I feel like we're primed to answer some of these questions that mm-hmm. I have. And these are kind of global questions. And I'm first of all, what's your favorite franchise?
I just Kirby. Want to hear
it. Kirby. I knew it. Yeah. I was also going to say, I bet we already know some
He
of
took
these.
Mine.
Wait, no, also Smash. Oh, no.
You have to pick one. You have to pick one.
But you really hate Melee.
I don't hate Melee. It's not accurate.
I mean, folks, if you've heard him talk about it.
We're going to have to grab some clips and replay this.
I talk about it like I do my brother. I love my brother.
Oh, okay. Well, that's news to me, too. All right, man. Yeah, well, I mean, whatever. Go ahead, pick one, then. I was trying to help you out.
No, okay. Skip.
Okay, Kirby, then. Mark, how about you?
It seems so boring, but I think Mario is my favorite franchise.
That's so good, though.
Yeah. I mean, I'm such a big proponent in the games I make of storytelling and theme, and Mario has so little of that.
Yeah.
That is funny.
But it is still my favorite games to play.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. I think for me, it's I feel like I should say like Metroid.
Yeah.
But I think I'm actually going to say Legend of Zelda. And it's not because I haven't played as many of the installments in the Legend of Zelda franchise as I have of Metroid.
Right.
Not that I'm like a deep expert on either one, but I think the impression that Breath of the Wild left on me was so powerful that like it cemented that's the standing for Legend of Zelda as my favorite franchise for like a long time.
That's so funny because no matter how much I love that game, it always feels like such a big extra example of a Zelda game.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And so I have only played a couple of other ones it's hard for me to think of my love for Breath of the Wild as reflecting on the rest of the franchise as much. True.
You know, actually, that's interesting.
I'm just not letting myself do that. I'm not saying that it's not a good idea to. I never think of it that way.
A friend of mine who's a big Zelda fan bounced off of Breath of the Wild because it's so different from the other Zelda.
Oh, huh, interesting.
Yeah. Except for like the first one. I feel like the Breath of the Wild is closer in spirit to the first Zelda game and maybe Wind Waker than the other Zelda games. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess that's a.
But you know what? If a game is that good, it could just bring the whole franchise up. You know, there's no reason they have to be, you know, like an outlier or not.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about something subjective, like what's your favorite one?
Yeah.
You need to do something like that. But I guess that leads me to something that maybe is as subjective, but maybe isn't as subjective. And that's just like the question of, well, what is a video game franchise overall? Because when I think of Mario games, there's like multiple franchises within Mario, right?
Oh,
there's
sure.
Like spin-off franchises. There's like the racing games.
Yeah, like I'm not counting Mario Golf.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, yeah.
But that's one of the things I like about Mario is that they are different mechanically.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In a way that's more than just this, like as different as Breath of the Wild is, there's still a lot of the hallmarks. It's still the same type of game as Twilight Princess, for example, despite it being radically different in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Whereas Mario, I think they're just not afraid to make the game play completely differently. There's some core movement that I think is probably people expect to be similar. I don't know, as I'm saying out loud, maybe I'm giving it too much credit compared to other franchises.
That's true. I think it's an emotional experience, too. Like, that's another thing that you can count on, right, that's in a franchise is like a type of emotional experience.
Right.
Yeah.
If there was a Dark Souls cart, you'd know exactly how that feels, right?
Slow and frustrating.
Right. I barely got through a fourth of this lap before I had to start over.
Yeah.
Okay, and then I tilt here.
You crashed.
Where would the obscure lore come in?
You have to stop every once in a while. Reese is hanging on the wall. Oh, that's so good.
not trying to rip on Dark Souls. I actually really do like the games. Yeah. I don't really play them, but I really do like them.
It is funny that we all picked Nintendo franchises.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that surprising, I guess. They've also been around longer. Maybe that's part of it. But
that's true.
Some of the best-selling franchises also, which is on the list of best-selling video game franchises that I pulled up from Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah. You know, I imagine a lot of us would, if you really were to, what is our actual favorites, might not be the ones that are the most popular, the ones we played the most.
Yeah.
But they're the easiest answers to have. When you think of franchise, you almost think of pop culture popularity.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's what qualifies it as a franchise, even though maybe games you liked better that had two or three installments, like, it wouldn't be the first thing you think of when you think of franchise.
Right. Like, we were just talking about Darkest Dungeon 2 in our Call to Action segment. Is Darkest Dungeon a franchise?
I mean, technically.
Yeah, but I don't really think of it as one.
Yeah. I mean, I'm making a Widget Satchel sequel for Playdate. It's technically a franchise now.
Yeah.
Woo! Okay, Widget Satchel. Sorry, Breath of the Wild. It's Widget Satchel. So I don't know. I guess just to kind of explore this idea a little bit more, like, what are some of the differences between what we think of as a video game franchise and other types of media franchises, like a movie franchise or like a multimedia franchise, like, you know, Star Wars has become.
The way I think of it really is just like a form of media that has at least two successes, I think, is kind of all you need for it to be a franchise.
Yeah.
Because like,
I mean, technically, but I think Ellen's asking a bigger question.
I like that answer, though, because it comes at it, the whole topic, from an angle that I honestly hadn't thought about, which is the commercial success of a thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, because like a lot of things nowadays are built so that they can try to be franchises,
right.
I think. Mm-hmm. So, like, ultimately, if they can make, like, just because you made one good movie doesn't mean that the rest of the movies will do well.
Universal made 3 movies in its Dark Universe before they pulled the plug on that.
Right.
No one would call that a franchise these days.
Exactly. Yeah, those were just failed movies.
Right. Well, people didn't even see the connections because the one wasn't successful enough, so they made another one but didn't make a lot of references to it.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Weird. Yeah, yeah. So, like, I think that it's important for a franchise to be... for people to recognize it as a franchise, so they need to see that it can
because be, then when the next one comes out, there's some buy-in.
Well, because that's
some expectations.
As far as I understand it, the purpose of a franchise is for people to have some form of a familiarity to it, which means that they have a general idea of what kind of experience they're going to go into
right.
it, and they have some trust built up with this brand,
right?
So they feel comfortable spending more money on it.
Right.
I guess I'm being a little cynical on it.
In which case, to answer Ellen's question, there is no difference then compared to any other type of media franchise.
I argue that.
With that lens applied, for sure. Yeah. And I guess that totally makes sense because I think to me that makes it easier for me to get my head around. Like these multimedia franchises where, you know, like, okay, we were talking about Star Trek earlier. Like there are tabletop games and there's TV shows and there's movies and there's probably comics and there's just so much out there. But there is like a similar thread between all of them, and you do have trust, and that trust is the thing that might lead you to buy something or watch something that you weren't necessarily going to, like a kid's Star Trek show.
That's a really good point, because I think one of the things I always talk about with Star Trek that's different from other franchises is that it has an ideology that others don't always, but that's not what makes it a franchise.
Yeah.
That's just the thing that makes it a franchise, right? Like Star Wars has a milieu that makes it a franchise, and that's not... No, that's not any less valid. Yeah.
There's an expectation in any Star Trek media that it has this, you know, that that ideology.
Right, like
that's the experience.
Like when people see the new Star Wars or they see the new Star Trek series, and they say this doesn't really feel like a Star Wars the way the old ones did, or whatever. Yeah. That's them basically trying to wiggle around that definition.
Yes. Because ultimately, like the idea of what a franchise isn't necessarily universal. Like when people think of Mario, they think of fun times and you can play or whatever. But that isn't necessarily a universal thing. I think some people have a hard time with certain Mario games. And some people don't find certain Mario games fun, despite the fact that they are, you know, cheerful.
So there's a really great YouTube video where somebody did a poll where they asked a bunch of people, tell me all the Mario games.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all they said.
Oh, interesting.
And some respondents replied, like, all the Mario Kart games were included, just all the ones they could remember.
Sure.
Some people said that Mario 2, because it was a adaptation of another game, the US version anyway, is not a Mario game. Some people say that the Japanese Mario 2, because it's essentially an expansion pack to the first Mario, is not a Mario game.
Mm-hmm.
And so the YouTube video kind of puts all these and says, what's the game that everyone can agree is a Mario game? Which I think was Super Mario World and none of those. And some people even thought the first Mario Super Mario Brothers wasn't. It goes into depth into like the data on what people say compared to what you might assume people would say.
Mm.
I don't know that it has a ton of great answers at the end of it, but it's really interesting because it's what we're talking about now is like our expectations, what we expect, what we personally define, and how that informs how excited we're going to be for the next in that franchise.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the franchises can be cross-definitional. So you could say, I love everything that Warner Brothers puts out. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's a person out there who says that, but you could...
everything.
Right? Maybe there's someone who you know, worked at the Warner Brothers lot for a summer and had a great experience and just loves Warner Brothers movies, right?
Yeah.
Or someone who sees all the movies that a certain actor is in.
Yeah.
That's a type of franchise, in at least the way we're describing it.
Yeah. Eat yourself.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's my last... Let me get closer to the mic.
Yeah.
Here's my last question before we wrap this thing up.
Mm-hmm.
And this might only be like the planting of a seed that we have to revisit and water again later.
Right.
But given what we just said about franchises and how a lot of it's about expectations, like what should indie developers think about when it comes to... If they want to build a franchise,
yeah.
What do you do?
I think this is definitely a case of, this might be a little bit more about the sort of fictional part of it, but there's a lot of, when you think about world building, like novelists will do all this world building that they just keep in their drawer, right? And it'll just inform their writing.
Yep.
I think you can do that if you want to build a franchise and not an IP, but a franchise in the way we're describing it.
Right. Yeah.
Now, of course, you have very few guarantees, far fewer than you do if you're Ubisoft trying to launch a new franchise.
Yes.
But you can think about it in similar terms about like, what is going to be the expectations that players have when the next one of these comes out? And how do I make sure that it's highlighted here? And what are the core things that are about this game? And what are the core things that I want to develop and do something larger? And you may change your mind as you make the second one of those. But I think having an idea, and that also maybe can help you with scope creep a little bit. You can say like, well, this game I'm making as the first of a franchise is going to be a lens into all of my great ideas. Mm-hmm. And then you don't have to do all your great ideas in one game.
That's yeah. true.
So maybe it's just a trick you play on yourself, which I endorse.
Yes.
Okay. I feel like it's dangerous to think of your game as a franchise. Because, I mean, then you'll do the thing that the Dark Universe did.
Yeah.
And you make like, three crappy movies.
I think, there's the lesson to be learned about holding back your best idea.
Yes.
I guess.
Yeah.
Which happens in movies a lot of times.
Right, right. You know? I don't think that, I mean, games are going to take a long time to make regardless of what you do.
Yeah.
So, like, it's probably best, unless your game takes a few weeks to make or something.
Yeah.
Even then, it's... I don't know.
You know, but as indie artists, replace franchise with artist statement, right?
Yeah,
like you make, there's a lot, I know a lot of developers who make small games and they're all very similar, but they're part of an evolving kind of statement,
yeah.
even though they don't have the same characters or anything, but and maybe they have some of the same mechanics, but a lot of that is just for expediency's sake or whatever.
Yeah.
That is a type of, you build a, I mean, another word for it is brand, which is a little bit crass, mm-hmm. but so if you think about an indie scale, like maybe you make puzzle games. Well, then that's your thing. And it's going to be, these are the four puzzle games I'm going to make. And, and they share some things in common, but really what they share in common is that I made them all.
But that, that's a discography. Discography. How do you say the word?
You basically got it.
Okay. you're describing, you know, the different things that like an artist has made.
Right.
You're kind of describing their like journey as they, you know, learn things and decide what they want to make in the future.
I think which is unavoidable. You're just going to do that.
Well, yes, exactly.
But I guess that's kind of what I was getting to is like mm-hmm. put yourself in your work.
Yes. I don't disagree with that either. I'm just arguing that that's not necessarily a franchise.
Yeah.
That's mm-hmm. what I'm saying. I think that like you're like
it's not going to be. It won't be written about in those terms.
Yeah.
Well, but I think the definition we set for it, I think this is a lens to it.
I guess that's not. I guess you're not. I guess I don't fully disagree with it or anything like mm-hmm. that. I think you have a point. I think that like.
All I ever want in life is for you to not fully disagree with me.
And for the most part, I think that's fair.
For the most part, he doesn't fully disagree. Yeah.
That's close enough. Yeah. You should take the win.
Yeah.
No, but I think that like. I guess I'm having a hard time not thinking about it outside of a marketing perspective.
Yeah.
Because like I think that like...
And maybe that's the more helpful definition. Like I'm just talking it out of existence, really.
Mm.
So I see your point.
I think that in order for a game to be a franchise, it has to have those two things I was saying. It needs to be a player needs to be able to understand what the experience they're going to get, and they need to be able to trust that they will get a decent experience from this thing.
Right. They're going to trust they're going to get a little bit of the same and they're going to get a little bit of something new.
Yes.
And so, this does feel very market driven.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Ellen, does this satisfy you? Like, what would be your definition?
No. Why did you ask? I don't. I think I don't know how I would have answered that question at the beginning of our conversation.
Yeah.
But towards the end of it, I do think I'm kind of leaning towards Steven's description of it because when I think about franchises in like a more casual sense, like as a player,
mm-hmm.
I think about some kind of more, some looser associations. Like we talked, we were joking around with Dark Souls a little bit earlier, but what I usually, and Eric's a huge fan of this franchise, my husband. Mm-hmm. And so whenever we're talking about it, we talk about Soulsborne, right?
Yeah.
Because it includes the game Bloodborne,
right.
Which of all the ones that I watched him play and freaked out while he was playing, because I'm very easily spooked. That one was definitely the spookiest. But like, it's not really part of the franchise, but it is talked about in like the same, as if it's part of this family.
Right.
So I think about it
right, because that's made by, so people say Metroidvania, they're talking about mechanics, but they weren't made by the same people.
Right, yes. Exactly.
The way that those two games were.
Yeah, exactly. Like the Dark Souls games and Bloodborne were.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are more and more games coming out. that are kind of in that family, and they're playing on the same kind of idea of shared expectations, but they're not necessarily all part of a franchise because they're not all the same shared story and characters. I don't know. I think that when we started this conversation, I was really hoping for franchise to lead to like a very specific like definition.
Right.
And now,
which is not how we do things here.
It's not how we do things here. Yeah. We break those things down. And now, now I'm thinking like from a player perspective, I'm just going to think of like families of games.
Yeah. Yeah.
And franchising is like a business and marketing term.
Right.
And it really only makes sense in that context.
As far as I understand, the term franchise comes from like restaurants, right? Like if you have two restaurants, then it's a franchise. Otherwise, you have a restaurant.
Or you have a chain of restaurants.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Dang it, that's different.
But if you have a franchise and it's like how it's structured at a corporate level, and then you have franchisees and things like that, but that doesn't really transfer over to games.
Yeah.
But on the other hand,
I think it is valuable to talk about it from like a game developer perspective.
Interesting. We wandered into like a higher minded notion of it, and then we realized, oh, we should probably just make a simple definition. And we're like, oh, it's actually really obvious what the simple definition is.
Yeah.
Did we waste our time? No, actually, we didn't. That's the nice games club experience, I think.
Yep.
But I mean, to your question, then, what do indies think about this? Do we just put it out of our minds and just let it be part of marketing later on? Or
I think, you know, I'm not even going to hold back. I'm going to agree with Steven 100%. I'm not even just going to not disagree with him.
Whoa.
Hey.
Because what I think you were saying earlier, Steven, is like, don't focus on building a franchise. Focus on making a good game.
Yeah.
And if you have a good game, then make your next good game. And if your next good game has similar elements to your first good game, well, then you might have the makings of a franchise started out. Mm. But like, focus on making good games. And if the franchise presents itself as an opportunity, we'll have you on the show. We'll ask you about it.
That's our show. Check out our website, nicegames.club, for show notes and links to resources on today's topics. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode and on our programming in general. Go to nicegames.club/feedback and tell us what you think. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter at Nice Games Club, where Dale tweets about game dev resources and learning UI design in real time. Or you can email us through contact@nicegames.club. Want to support the show? There are so many ways. Give us a review on your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends about your favorite episodes. Join us on Discord by visiting nicegames.club/discord. And also we're on Patreon. As a patron of the show, you'll get to enjoy bonus content, extra jokes, and more. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. My voice kind of broke there. And make nice.
Let's do one more take.
And make nice.
That's it. And having that, I've lost my train of thought. Maybe if I am editing this one, I'll cut that part out.
Well, if it's any consolation, Mark, my brain is also tired. And the evidence of that is that I've had the Super Mario World like fast music going back through my head the last 5 minutes. Like, and just for the last 5 minutes.
Cool.
You know, there's you guys talking about things that are smart, and then in the background it's just that.